Well, I spent some time in this last week down at the local bookstore in preparation for this talk as research looking in the religion section, and it was an education. There's books on anything and everything you can think of. You know, the powers of crystals, soul health books, books on all the major religions of the world, as well as a bunch of religions I didn't even know existed. As I flicked through them, a few caught my attention. One of them was the Egyptian Book of the Dead by Ramses Salim. The Book of the Dead is full of words to be recited and enacted by the living to help the dead in their journey through the underworld. So if you've tragically lost grandma, or you've just wrapped up your dead pharaoh, there's words to say to help them find their way to the Garden of Reeds and true peace. The right words to say, the right ritual at the right time to get the right results. Now I've got to say, 5 minutes with Dr. Salim left my head spinning, so I soon moved on to Chinese Religions by Janine and Merv Fowler, which, after tracing through a history of the key dynasties, is straight into the rhythms of the universe and the yin and the yang, and an overview of the Tao rituals. It outlined all the rituals and festivals to mark the seasons, and it's all trying to restore balance, to restore cosmic harmony. In practice, the book says, these days ordinary people in China tend to mix and match. A bit of Taoism, a bit of Confucius, a mixture of all kinds of gods and spirits and philosophies. But typically, they've all got shrines and some similar principles, like washing your hands in a fountain and throwing money in the pool to bribe the local spirits to keep away. And there's a god for everything, even a kitchen god. That's about how far I got with that one. And so I moved on to the A to Z Guide to the Catholic Faith, which was chock full of washings and incense and ceremonies as well, which made me realise that every book I picked up had the same formula. A bunch of rituals, a bunch of things to do to somehow get God's attention, whoever you conceive that God to be, with a hope that it will shape certain outcomes. The right words, with the right actions, done at the right ways, at the right time. No wonder many people think that all religions are the same. But is this what Jesus wants? Is this what Jesus modelled? It may be astonishing when you look at all the rituals of the cathedrals and the ornate vestments that have become part of mainstream Christianity, but if you think Jesus is interested in religious practices and rituals, well, let me say this politely, I think you'd be very mistaken. In fact, if you think God is impressed by the stuff we call religion, you might need to rethink that as well. If you think doing particular things at particular times in particular ways somehow wins God's heart, I want to suggest to you today that you may have got God all wrong, which is something the Old Testament prophet said over and over again, especially the prophet Hosea that we heard read in our first reading, who, speaking for God, puts it this way, "What can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you, Judah? Your love is like the morning mist, like the early dew that disappears. For I desire mercy, not sacrifice, and acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. What I want, says God, is affection for me and for others. Not a bunch of sacrifice animals, not a bunch of empty words." You know, it's a sad picture, really, when you go back and look at the people of Israel at this time, hundreds of years before Jesus, and they're the worst of both worlds. On one hand, they're deeply religious. They're doing all their religious ceremonies and special days and sacrifices, but at the very same time, they're corrupt, a city of evildoers. The priest, says Hosea, they're crooks, wicked. The people of God are unfaithful. There's prostitution, there's crime. The innocent are condemned, the guilty walk free. And there is no mercy. And they think that by doing that little bit of religion on the surface, by going through the motions, God will somehow be pleased with them. I guess it's like getting along to church a couple of times a month and taking communion and getting baptized and somehow thinking that gives you a license to live the rest of your life however you wish. Well, by the time we get to Jesus, hundreds of years later, nothing's changed. Have a look at the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who are following the footsteps of Jesus here in Matthew chapter 9. Jesus arrives back in Galilee and is met by some men carrying their quadriplegic friend on a mat. Seeing their great faith, Jesus heals the man, but not before getting the religious hierarchy upset by first claiming to forgive the man's sins. Let's pick up the episode from verse 1. Jesus stepped into a boat, crossed over and came to his own town. Some men brought to him a paralyzed man lying on a mat. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the man, "Take heart, son, your sins are forgiven." At this, some of the teachers of the law said to themselves, "This fellow is blaspheming." Knowing their thoughts, Jesus said, "Why do you entertain evil thoughts in your hearts? Which is easier to say, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Get up and walk'? But I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins." So he said to the paralyzed man, "Get up, take your mat and go home." The man got up and went home. When the crowd saw this, they were filled with awe and they praised God who had given such authority to the man. You see, where the crowds are filled with awe and praise God for what Jesus has done, the teachers of the law are angered by his blatant act of blasphemy. For they reasoned, I take it, that only God can forgive sins. Which, of course, is true. Only the one sinned against can forgive those who sin against them. They rightly see that Jesus here is claiming to be God, and they're appalled. But when Jesus heals the man, well, they're left to seethe in silence. For what could they say when the crowd has been so won over by him? And so the clash between the religious leaders of Jesus' day and Jesus begins. And this only heats up in the next thing that takes place, where Jesus seems to be going out of his way to send a message to these leaders, this time to the hyper-religious Pharisees that take offence at Jesus for breaking all their rules. Now, we've all had many goes over the years of trying to explain who these Pharisees are. They're not priests. They don't work the temple in their day. They're more like the Taliban or a political party whose one campaign platform is being rigorously religious, being absolutely, precisely obedient to every religious law and rule and requirement that they could think of, and making sure that every other Jew does it as well. And they thought that by doing this, God will bless them and restore their national glory. And so here's Jesus, Matthew 9 verse 9, breaking all the rules, spending time with all the wrong people. And we start by meeting Matthew, the tax collector, sitting at his booth collecting tax for the Romans. Now here's the thing, Matthew is Jewish, but he's the exact opposite to the Pharisees. The Romans, you see, they're in charge, they've been so for years, and Matthew says, forget about religious purity, there's a buck to be made here. The Romans are in charge, I can see that, so I'm going to work for them and squeeze tax dollars out of my fellow Jews and keep, of course, a nice percentage for myself. Religious Jews like the Pharisees hated the tax collectors for this, and they hated the other irreligious people that they hung out with. And yet we're told that when Jesus sees Matthew, he calls him. Verse 9, he says to Matthew, "Follow me." And at an instance, Matthew does. Right there, he gets up and literally walks behind him. He shuts up shop and follows Jesus. And he takes Jesus home for dinner. And you'll see there in verse 10, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with Jesus and his disciples. Now this is the first of a pair of stories that happens in the last part of our passage. And each one features a question, well, really disguised as an objection, but a question about being religious. The first question, verse 11, the Pharisees asked the disciples to explain Jesus' behaviour. The second section we'll come to in verse 14, the disciples of John asked Jesus to explain the behaviour of the disciples. They kind of function as a pair. So let's have a look at that first question. When the disciples saw this, verse 11, when they saw the kind of irreligious, sinful people that Jesus was eating with, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" People who, by our religious standards, are meant to be excluded. At which point Jesus says, "I'm not here to help the self-righteous. I'm not here to fix the healthy. I'm here for the kind of people who know they've got a problem, who recognise they're sinners and need to be saved." You see, friends, the point is that everyone has this problem, this sin problem, and yet not everyone knows it. And Jesus says that the solution for people like that, it isn't to avoid them and stay ceremonial pure like the Pharisees have set up. It isn't to lump them with a whole bunch of religious rules and procedures so that somehow they might be able to get better and get closer to God. No, the solution is Dr. Jesus, or Dr. J, as our little mini-series puts it, who, as we saw back in chapter 8, has not come first and foremost to cure diseases, but to forgive sins. And then he quotes to them from the prophet Hosea in that passage we looked at earlier. "Here's a lesson for you Pharisees," he says, verse 13. "But go and learn what this means." I mean, you're meant to be the Old Testament experts. What did God mean, do you think, when he asked, when he said, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice"? Now, I think he's using sacrifice there to wrap up all the religious things that these Pharisees are so good at. You know, they've got it perfect. They're just missing an important ingredient, mercy. They've got the religious side of things down to a fine art, and yet they're doing it with a hard heart. Jesus says, "I haven't come to call the righteous, but sinners. That's who I'm here for." Except, of course, there are no righteous, are there? Only the self-righteous, like our Pharisees. Well, here's question two. This time for Jesus, about his disciples. It's a question from the disciples of John the Baptist who were doing it tough with John out in the wilderness, living on locusts, going hungry, treating their bodies harshly. It's a feature of lots of religions today. And while the Old Testament sets out just one or two fast days for Israel, the Pharisees and disciples of John, well, they've come up with a whole new level when it comes to fasting. And so John's disciples come to Jesus and ask him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" In fact, just the opposite. I mean, "We see your disciples going party with tax collectors and sinners. How come your disciples are free to celebrate while we are being so religiously devout when it comes to our fasting?" Well, here's the answer, verse 15. "When I'm around," says Jesus, "we've got everything to celebrate. Now's not the time for mourning," which of course is at the heart of fasting. Fasting was a religious grief ritual. The Pharisees did it often to try and attract God's attention and their sincerity so that God could see that they were sincere. But as we've seen, God doesn't want that. He wants mercy. He wants the affections of his people for him and for others. And here is Jesus, he's standing right there among them. And he says, "Now's not the time for a funeral, it's the time for a wedding. For here amongst you the bridegroom has come. How can the guests mourn?" Although he says, and this is a hint of what's to come in the rest of Matthew, there will be a time that the bridegroom will be taken from them, and then they'll fast. There is a time of grief to come for the disciples of Jesus, when they see him nailed to the cross, when they see him dead and buried in the tomb, then they will fast. "In the meantime," says Jesus, "God's not that interested in your fasting." And he goes on to use these couple of analogies. It's a bit like, he says, putting a new patch of fabric onto an old garment to repair it. You put it in the wash, that new piece of fabric shrinks and the rip gets worse. Now, I speak as an expert because I'm married to a textiles teacher, and so about 25 years or so ago, I learnt this little trick. Apparently, new pieces of clothes shrink. Yes, we kind of get that. So you never put a new piece of fabric onto an old shirt, otherwise it's not going to work. Well, there we go. Jesus knew that too. So don't do that. Next bit, of course, is the new wine into old wineskins. Old wineskins, they've dried up. Put new wine in it. It ferments and breaks open that old wineskin because it can't handle it anymore. You put new wine into new wineskins. Two very simple analogies, very well known at the time, to make the point that the Israelites need to realize that we can't just put in the new way of doing things now with Jesus into the old Israelite religion in the way that they have been running things. Because, you see, God's interested in mercy, not sacrifice. He's interested in mercy, not a petty piety that separates you from sinners and has you constantly looking down on everyone else. He's looking at mercy, not fasting in the desert. And it's a mercy for sinners that will go all the way to the cross. Friends, if you think that Jesus is all about rules and rituals, if you think that what he is most interested in is living by all the Sabbath rules and fasting rituals, if you think he's interested in ceremonies and cathedrals, if you think he's impressed by our liturgy or our communion services, well, frankly, you'd be mistaken. If you think that Jesus is looking for you to get all religious, if you think that's what Christianity is, then you simply have not understood what Jesus wants from you. I mean, maybe that is the way you think. And you think that because you've been baptized or christened, and because you take communion and turn up to church most weeks, that God will be pleased with you. I mean, you're a clean living person, living with clean living friends. You listen to 103.2 and you vote for the Christian political parties. I mean, what more could God want from you? That's Christianity 101, and you're passing with flying colours. Friends, is that the way you think? Well, if you do it, you make a pretty good Pharisee, but I think you might be a million miles away from being a Christian. You see, if you bring it all together, what is it that Jesus is looking for from us? What are you going to look like if you're committed to Jesus? What's going to define a follower of Jesus if it's not being outwardly religious? Well, the simple answer is this. You'll look like a forgiven sinner who loves God and shows mercy to others. You'll look like a forgiven sinner who loves God and shows mercy to others. That is to say, step one, you'll come to Jesus recognizing your sin and you'll be hungry to meet him, your Saviour. Funny, isn't it, when you look back at the party at Matthew's house, it's full of all the sorts of people that have got life wrong. The sort of people who aren't quite safe to be with, but they're drawn to Jesus like a magnet. Because you see, these are the ones that know their need, and they know where to find it met. They're hanging off Jesus' every word. They've come to Dr. Jesus, not because they're so righteous, but because they're not. And at some point, that was you and me, wasn't it? Or to put it another way, that needs to be you and me if we're going to count ourselves as Christians. Church, you see, friends, is not a hotel for the saints. It's a hospital for sinners. And maybe you've just come and turned up as a visitor with flowers and chocolates, but at some point you need to allow yourself to be diagnosed and admitted, which is a humbling start, isn't it? And this is the problem with what Jesus says today. Religion is easy. I mean, yeah, sure, it's a lot of work, but it's easy. Relationship, well, that's a little harder. And recognizing that you're a sinner needing to be saved, well, that's very humbling. But that's vital if we're to go to step two. For once you are forgiven, you respond by loving God and showing mercy to others. You see, from the heart you become a mercy-filled person. You just can't fake that, can you? It's a natural consequence of step one, being forgiven. Or at least it should be. God's kingdom is populated not by people who are more religious than other people, but by forgiven sinners who love God and show mercy to others. And that's what we need to ask ourselves. Is that us? Is that what people would see in us? I mean, it'll show in who you're prepared to mix with. I mean, even here at church. Are you driven by mercy and think first of the feelings of others in a way you decide who you're going to sit with this week? Is there someone new on their own? Someone needing a friendly word? Or is it just you want to be comfortable with your own friends and looking pity on those who don't quite fit in? But it's more than that, isn't it? Is there any sense in any of the things that you do and think and say where mercy is what drives you? Are you geared toward caring for the needs of others or just for yourself? Were you the first to run up to the table when it came to Toys and Tucker because you know that there are people out there in need that that you can do something about? Is that the way you go about life, looking for how you can serve others? Do you give anything, do anything, say anything that's motivated by a merciful heart for others out of love for God? Because if you do, that's what Jesus is looking for from his children. When you do, James says later on, that's when you've been truly religious, in a good way. James 1:27, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. You see, the Pharisees, they see a refugee and they say that's their fault. They've got themselves into that circumstance, that's their fault. They look at the unemployed and they say, well, that's their bad choices. They see the marginalised and the down and out and say they just need to clean up their act. And you know, you can think these things, you can say these things, I've noticed, and still appear very religious in all the ways that Jesus despises. If you think Jesus came so that we could all dress up and do rituals, or so that we can all point the finger at people and act as though we're better than they are, then our passage today shows us that we're not talking about the real Jesus. Now, what Jesus models for us in this passage and what he wants from us is a heart that loves God and that's so transformed by his love for us that we would act mercifully towards others. Well, friends, we're going to now share communion together. And after a sermon like this, that's a bit risky, isn't it? Why? Well, I guess it depends what you think communion is. For some, it may be your religious ritual. I know of some people that don't come to church unless it's communion. I know some people who don't think they've gone to church unless they've had communion. You see, for some, you might think that God is impressed with you when you take communion. That he takes special notice of you when you eat the bread and drink the cup because it mystically makes you holy as you inwardly digest the presence of Jesus into your life. Now, friends, that actually is not what communion is at all, is it? It's not our own personal time of religious piety, but a communal time, together, remembering the very thing that brought us together as a church, the death and resurrection of Jesus in our place. Communion is something we do together as fellow forgiven sinners who have been saved by Jesus. And its very purpose is to help us to love God and look with mercy and grace upon one another as those who needed Dr. Jesus to heal and save them, just like we did. Well, Bruce is going to come up and lead us in a time to encourage each other with communion. And so not to fall into the trap of doing it religiously, like we've always done, We're going to do things a little differently today. As Bruce comes up, I'm just going to say this though. There's nothing wrong with doing a liturgy. There's nothing wrong with doing communion in the way we do it, as long as our head's in the right place. That's the key, isn't it? And so to get our head in the right place today, Bruce is going to mix it up a little bit to make sure that we're understanding what we're doing as we do communion together. Thanks, Bruce.